Hello and namaste. I'm Peter Furco, and this is Peter's podcast, where we talk about real yoga, actual happiness, and deep living. Thanks for joining me. Today I talked to regular podcast contributor Jenny Bloom, who is an Ishta yoga teacher and a strategic brand consultant. We discuss finding peaceful relationships with yourself, with others, and with the world. And we talk about Peace Pilgrim, an activist who walked across America between 1951 and 1981, spreading a message of personal and world peace. I hope you enjoy our chat. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, Peter.
You're on your cell phone.
I was going to take a picture of us doing this so that people could see.
Let's take a picture of us doing this. How are you?
I am doing.
You're doing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, sounds...
New Yorkish.
It's a provocative statement.
Yeah, I wish I was being more and doing less.
Hmm. Yeah, well, we're always doing. Mm-hmm. We have to like have a little being and a mostly doing.
Yeah. It sucks. In my dream reality, I'm living on a beach and all of the happy city people come and just get to completely relax on this beach that I live on.
Yeah.
And then they leave and then I'm back by myself on the beach.
Mm-hmm. And what you've just described is yoga practice.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like you have to find your own inner beach and go there.
Mm-hmm.
And then have nice interactions with all the people in your life. And then go back to the beach and recharge 18 minutes in a meditation. And then go back and help all those people have their same beach time, right? Through the gifts that you bring through your life.
Mm. Yeah.
And it takes us some time to figure out what that is, and it's part of practice for many people is to find that. Like some people just like they wake up knowing, oh, I want to be a doctor, or you know, they stumble into something and it's like, wow, I love what I do. But for other people,
I so rarely meet those people.
Yeah,
I think they do exist.
But I don't, or they're like just content with whatever it is that's making them enough money that they can do the things that they want to do on the side. Like they meant to be a football player, but they stumbled into real estate and then it's okay. They like it, you know?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. You know. But I think there's probably a reason why I'm not really meeting these people who are deeply satisfied with their careers.
Mm.
Probably because I'm in my own place of dissatisfaction and striving and climbing up the mountain and seeing like, so much of what I'm doing right now in my career feels like rock climbing.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's like those moments where I'm holding onto the rock and I have my foot and both of my hands in little tiny, tiny rivets in the rock. And I'm not exactly sure where to put my arm again so that I can climb to the next peak.
Yeah.
But I'm holding on and I'm getting stronger in that holding on.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, when you go to the beach and you get some insight at the beach about where should I put my hand next, then you come out and you do that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I've been reading this book about this woman named Peace Pilgrim that I mentioned to you. And she was an activist who got concerned about the nuclear speak. You know, in the 1950s, she got really concerned that we were going to be building nuclear arsenals. And we thought that that was a way to peace. And she ended up putting on this tunic that had the words Peace Pilgrim on it. And she walked, describing how to find peace for real. And she walked from 1951 to 1981 and was on the radio and on the newspaper and on television and didn't write books, but, you know, had lots of opportunities to get stuff down. People transcribed her speeches and things like that. And so there are a few books that are quote unquote by her But what was fascinating to me in reading this book, which was a compilation of a lot of these writings, is that she had some sense of wanting to find what she was supposed to do with her life. And she had a sense that it was what was going to be important, that it had to be something she came to, discovered, right? That it wasn't just going to be whatever. Right?
She wasn't going to find it pre-made.
Yeah, like or that she wasn't going to just drop into somebody else's idea of life. Like she said, I found early on making money was easy. You know, which for a lot of people, that would be like such a statement of,
yeah.
Can you tell me how?
Very few people in New York.
Yeah. So she knew that but it taught her right away that the making money part wasn't something that was satisfying to her. So it made her look beyond that. Mm-hmm. And so she went through what, as I was reading, it sounded very much like a yoga practice. You know, she was sort of taking down the things that weren't going to serve her and trying to arrange her life and organize her life and make priorities that were going to serve this higher sense of what was going to be her life. And the only place I heard of her was when she was the Peace Pilgrim. So I just kind of had this assumption that it wasn't even a smart assumption. I just only thought of her as when she was walking. But of course, she had a whole life before that. And it was very much like, as I was growing up, I started to notice that if I wanted something, I had to kind of give that something. So if I wanted people to be kind, I had to be kind to them. So she sort of discovered this golden rule idea. Right? Treat others as you'd like to be treated. And that set a stage for a certain part of the way that she lived. And then from there, she stumbled onto a sense of what was the thing that connected us all. What was, and she uses the word God, but she uses it just because it's convenient, because she never had a formal religion. She, as she said, she stepped into a church for the first time when she was 16. And she kept asking, what's God? What's God? And no one could give her an answer. So she went looking for herself and came to it, right? Partly through observation, partly through discernment, partly through meditation, which was another thing she discovered. When I went and got quiet, when I walked in the woods, when I sat and thought about things for a long time, then I came to understandings. And so she basically built what we use as yoga practice for herself, and then thought, what's the most important thing I could do? I have to get people to understand that war is not the way to peace.
Yeah.
Or we're going to be blown up. So she said, and then in that learning of that golden rule kind of stuff, and that and the layers and the what's important first, she realized that the way you get peace in society is for individuals to find peace in themselves. So as she walked, that's what she taught. Wow. And then she taught that, you know, when we find that, then we'll have peace on all these other levels, like in the community and in the government and in the state and in the, like her whole idea was we would become peaceful and we would keep seeing ourselves as a bigger picture, right? Almost like when we say namaste, we know we're individuals, but we see ourselves as the whole. So she said, you know, the only thing I can imagine that we would ever need is like a United Nations where at some point they would be like this educational organization that would help people understand what was causing friction.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
That's beautiful. It's so pristine. It's such a clear vision.
And yet she says it was hard the whole way. All of the learning was challenging. It didn't come easy. The idea was simple, but it took work.
And right. Courage.
Oh, my God.
Like to...
Total trust.
Yeah.
In the universe.
Yeah. Yeah. And this insight, this intuition that she had received.
Yeah.
It always strikes me when I have these moments of insight how simple things really are. Things really are simple. but the mind complicates it. And yeah. our patterns, the things that we have been doing over and over again, the ways that we process our the information that we receive, that kind of pulls me out of these simple core understandings. But what is so powerful for me about this practice, about yoga practice and meditation, is I keep coming back. So I keep coming back to this place. It doesn't matter how deeply enmeshed I get in my own patterns, my own inadequacies and fears and anxieties and thoughts.
Yeah.
No matter how deeply I get into believing those, what we would call avidya in right. yoga talk.
Right. Confusion about what it really is.
I get to come back to my practice because I almost feel like I've earned it.
Yeah.
By returning. It's not anything else. It's just coming back to sitting, coming back to my teacher's class, yeah. coming back to my class.
Well, it's the opposite of avidya. It's the seeing what really is. And what really is, and I'm trying to avoid that construction, but what really is the you are all those other things. And you are this ability to go into the stillness, into the practice place, and recharge and regroup and reorganize and bring inspiration back into the rest of it all, so that that moves toward what Peace Pilgrim found after her, you know, ad-libbed yoga practice.
I find that when I first started practicing, I was very interested in what happens in meditation. What's happening? Am I seeing the light? Do I see the light? Is the light growing brighter? What does it look like? Oh my God, I saw the light. La la la. We talk about jyoti, which is this light that appears, this light of transformation that appears when you draw your attention up towards third eye center. And what I've learned, it's almost been 7 years since I discovered Ishta. What I've learned in this time is it doesn't matter what happens in your meditation. It doesn't matter.
Right.
Even if your mind is very active, even if it's physically difficult to sit and you want to come out and you go back in, whatever's happening in that space is what needs to happen. The practice is about the practice.
Right.
It's pristine in a way too. In life, we get...
It's the ultimate. It's the sublime. I mean, and that word sounds like unattainable mm-hmm, or perfect in a way of like a diamond or something, you know, but it's mucky. It's perfect in the way that life is perfect because mm-hmm. we're in life mm-hmm. and we're having meditation there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's like turning off the computer. It's sublime in the way that turning off the computer... And then turning it back on helps the computer function.
Reboot. Yeah. Well, even just like when you're, you know, you're listening to something on a TV or on a radio, or you're on your computer and you're scrolling through things and you're done, but you're still scrolling through things. When you turn that off is suddenly sublime. It's that nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Where there was all this stuff, now there's pause.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that pause that we need to take. Someone was just speaking, and I have to look up I have to look it up because apparently a book came out of it. But it was a project on WNYC, where and I'm sorry I don't have the details, but I'll put them in the show notes. This journalist did a project of having people give up their devices for a while, and it was something along the lines of. Boredom, like what is the benefit of boredom? And they specifically use this word boredom because we are so accustomed now to occupying ourselves when we feel this sense of, oh, I'm not doing anything. What is this? And it's not necessarily the times when you like to, like you're sitting staring at the ocean, but like when you're sitting on the subway and you're not doing anything, or you're just in your house in your living room And instead of turning on the TV, you're just sitting there, you know, and it can feel like boredom if you're not accustomed to it. But the point of, or the outcome of some of this research was that during that quote unquote boredom time, we do so much, even beyond without meditation in the mix, we do so much processing and health processing and building concepts of how are we going to pursue the things that we want and all of this stuff that we're not giving ourselves time to do anymore.
Right, right. And work, and a lot of work doesn't give people time to do these things anymore.
Yeah.
Because it's like there's this obsession with this like producing.
Yeah, with activity instead of productivity.
Right. And there really is a need. Like scientists are studying these things. There's a need to have a space to contemplate in order to really be with your best solutions. Like Einstein, I remember reading this book about how Einstein would discover these amazing things that no one had ever discovered. Mm-hmm. And often when he'd find a problem that he, like, I personally deeply love this, he'd find a problem that he couldn't figure out. So he would say, huh, I wonder about that. And then he would take a nap.
Right. The nap method.
Yeah, the nap method. But he would often, and what he said was it was that dreaming. It's in that dream state where he was able to envision the solution, envision that understanding, make that connection beyond the rational, beyond the quotidian mind. And in that space, he was able to see, oh, this is how that works. And then he could backtrack it.
Right. And we call that state samyama, this place between the highest meditative state and being back in the world, that you can use that shift into the quiet that taps you into inspiration, insight, knowing, and then point your mind at something and gain insight into that. So what Einstein was doing was using this samyama, again, inventing yoga practice, you know, because it's the yoga isn't a thing. It's a technology around what people do, right? So it's not like you have to learn.
It's a technology.
Yeah, thing is the wrong word. It's not like you have to do yoga to have the experiences that yoga brings you to. It's that yoga is a way of getting to this place that people naturally have in them. Mm-hmm. We naturally have the capacity to go still in our mind and do that. Like Wendy and I were speaking once about how, you know, I wonder if in the past when there wasn't electricity and people sat around staring at rivers and sat around the fire and stared at the fire because they didn't have anything else to say, if there wasn't a whole lot more spontaneous meditative experiences, because why wouldn't there be?
Right.
You're concentrating, your concentration becomes effortless, and then you move into the next natural state.
You merge.
Yeah. So yoga saw a way to get there, right? And it's a very efficient way. It's like to do this, do that, right? But there are other ways to get to that state because it's a natural state for us to be in.
Yeah. And then going back to the idea of you sitting on the couch and saying, oh, it's okay for me to scroll through my Instagram feed for 5 minutes, half an hour, an hour, 2 hours, like, which I personally do, even as a yogi. What that takes, it doesn't seem like it's taking anything, but it's taking that capacity, the cultivation of the capacity, but even that, I don't even know exactly how to put it. Maybe you have a more eloquent way of describing it, but it's that capacity that one would have to figure out something very deep for oneself, or to connect with something very deep, or to have that real happiness, to be able to have that moment and that consciousness around the moment. We don't see what we're missing.
Yes. We don't give ourselves a chance because we encourage the mind to keep meandering.
Spinning, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And so that we don't do the things that would naturally take place when we pause that, right?
Yeah.
A big part of an artistic practice, for instance, is doing nothing, waiting for the inspiration. You might sit yourself in front of your medium, whether it's a canvas or a piano or a stage or whatever, and the idea would come to you. I was just speaking with a good friend of mine last night who's a writer, and her husband picked up the phone and goes, oh no, she went out to the studio because she said, oh, I got this great idea. And so he said, well, get out there in the studio and write it down. You know, ideas come. This insights come, inspiration comes, right? It's a small step from that place, which is like this samyama place, right? We're in life, but we're also in the inspiration. It's a small step to just go to the inspiration. But as long as you keep encouraging your mind to go out instead, there's no way.
Right. Because it won't bring you back. It's like, I see it like water, like the surf. The way that the surf goes out and then comes back in. And when it goes out, it's taking whatever
it makes a big jingle. Yeah. I like how that happens with the water.
Yeah. And then when it comes back, it's bringing new.
Yeah.
And everything ebbs and flows in life, in these cycles. This is a part of the moon, for example. The moon, like new moon, there's nothing in the sky that you can see. And then as the month goes on, you see more and more and more moon until the moon gets totally full. And then when it's full, the only thing it can do is get empty again.
Mm-hmm.
And everything follows these cycles in life. And one of the places where I think our culture and our societies are deeply sick and distorted is in not tracking these natural cycles.
Yeah.
In not knowing where the moon is. In not knowing that when something new comes into your life, it's going to become something.
Yeah.
Or it goes very quickly.
Yeah. And like one of the beauties of the Tantra yoga that we tap into at Ishta, and you know, Tantra yoga has many different schools, but is that you can gain the knowledge, the understanding of the whole through any of the parts, right? So you just said, you know, knowing the cycles of the moon is important, but what's important is the last thing you said, which is knowing that things go through cycles, right? Mm-hmm. So you might learn that from watching the moon. Mm-hmm. You might also learn it by deeply meditating on the nature of anything, because everything goes through cycles. Everything has a beginning, a middle, an ending, a rebirth. Another middle, another ending, a rebirth. So,
but we're so fortunate because we have a moon.
Well, yeah, there we have an everything,
right?
You know?
But it's so hard. I think that what's so powerful for me, what's been powerful for me in my practice, in connecting with nature and in connecting with the cycles that I see on the outside, and being a woman and having my own womanly cycles, is being able to take it out of my head.
Yeah.
It's just been so, it's a relief. There's so much relief.
Yes.
In doing that.
Yes. There's definitely something about going outside your normal realm that tricks your mind out of its storytelling. You know, I used to experience it with art, where I would be like working on music and working on my band and having this and that, and then dealing with all of the business side of things. But then I would step out and do a painting, and it's like the painting was the most beautiful thing I could possibly conceive of doing, because it was just the pure art without any of the baggage of my thinking about the art business, you know? And but so what you're saying makes total sense as a city girl, especially to turn your focus to nature as an example of something that seems foreign, but it's not foreign. It's in your every cell is going through that process.
Yeah.
Like the moon. I hope you're enjoying today's episode of Peter's Podcast. I'm making this podcast as a natural extension of teaching yoga and writing about topics important to me. Using authentic yoga practice, theory, and philosophy has made such a profound impact on my life that I want to share it with you. The ability to find calm in times of stress, real happiness, purposeful work, and balanced relationships is priceless. Rather than making you listen to random advertisements to fund this work, I'm asking you to value this content directly. Go to patreon.com/peterspodcast to subscribe. I'm offering you ways to tailor the content of this podcast to you. Subscribe at any level you like. Take advantage of the rewards, like various opportunities to work one-on-one with me. Thank you for listening. Go to patreon.com/peterspodcast.
I remember going to Maine with my mom after a particularly painful breakup a number of years ago. And we went to Acadia National Park right in the beginning of spring, like right when it was starting to come out of winter. And there was this one giant white treed forest that we walked through, and the barks were all coming off, and there was this like
birch trees.
Yeah, like white birch trees. Mm-hmm. And just being there and seeing some of the trees were just falling down, and some of the trees were like had no leaves, and some of that, well, none of them had really leaves because the leaves hadn't come in, but just the disarray of it.
Yeah.
But the beauty and the wholeness in the disarray. And to be able to have that reflection, that mirror for myself, that I was hurting in that moment, but that was okay. And part of the cycle, I was at that part, you know, with the cycles, things come in, they develop. And then there's the giveaway, the piece, this is like native wisdom, like the giveaway, the part that's not, that is not yours anymore. Mm-hmm. You have to give it away.
Even your entire life, you know, your body you give away.
Yeah, even your entire entire life in your body, you come into that place where there's just stillness.
Yeah.
And where nothing happens until something new comes in.
Yeah.
And it's a whole new cycle.
Yeah. And the nature of our time here, our living, what in Sanskrit they call lila, the dance of life, is these limitations that are imposed on the whole of things, right? So, like, when there's not a big bang, right, whatever that was, you can't even say before because there's no time, right? Once that comes, like, once there's this kind of existence that we have, the way yogis think of it, I think, is very elegant. It's this idea that there are limitations placed on the infinity of it all, right? And those are time, that things now are going to take place one after another, that there is form instead of everythingness, there's this and there's that and there's the other thing, that there is cause and effect, so that when something happens, something else is a result of that. So there is some
linearity.
Reactivity in the universe, right? I do something so that something else happens, right? Cause instead of it all just being, right?
Yeah.
And then you have knowledge, so that where there used to be just knowing of everything, suddenly you have like a limited knowledge where there's enough to get you going, right? So that you can live, you can be in the dance of life, right? And then there's attraction so that you care about anything enough to do it, to set these things in motion, to go make an effect, to want something to occur so that you get it later, you know, so that all of these characteristics together create what we experience every day. And you can't not have those limitations when you're living in life. The nature of our tale right here, the dance, is those things. So we can go into meditation and use this technical word, right? Transcend that limitation piece and have a sense of what we are without these limitations. Feel ourselves like outside of our body, outside of time, without any desire. And have that, and then come back into life. And then the things of life are different. They look different,
right? As the more you're caught up in the limitations, the more you sort of honor all those limitations, like, oh, I'm really upset, but it takes time to get over being upset, right? Because you buy the limitations. Mm. If you can get strong in your yoga practice, you can conceivably see things as they are beyond the limitations and come back and go, well, I let go of that, right?
Yeah, it doesn't take
I'm not attached
long.
To that.
But it also doesn't make you into like I think that it doesn't make you into a robot. You know, I've met certain people who have meditation practices and they're like, it's almost like they're trying to like scrub clean their like emotional bodies so that they don't feel anything anymore. And I just feel so sad for like that experience, because it's really pain and pleasure that make us do everything. It's just our attachments that
and they teach us our role. They teach us what our thing is that we're supposed to be doing, what we desire.
Right.
What we're attracted to, those are the things that help us, you know?
What you were talking about in terms of the transitions from the Big Bang, I'm reading this really interesting book by the guy who runs the Natural History Museum about subatomic particles, and we'll put the actual book title. Neil deGrasse Tyson. And it's so interesting.
Astrophysics
for busy people.
Busy people.
Okay. Yes. Oh my God. What a brilliant book. And
I got to see him with Lindsay Sandwald and a friend of hers.
Oh, cool. Yeah, was that when you guys met Whoopi Goldberg?
Yes.
Okay, cool.
That's great. So let's name drop some more.
Yeah. Okay. That's all I got. but anyway, so this book, Subatomic Particles, it talks about this field, this zero-point field, this quantum field. And what I think we're doing in meditation is we're moving towards that quantum field. We're stripping away all of the aspects of our, you know, like time, focus outwards, like attraction, cause and effect, reactivity. We're moving away from those things so that we can just be with what is.
Yeah.
In the container. And it's not even necessarily, you're not even necessarily going anywhere. You're not even necessarily, your thoughts aren't necessarily changing that much. You're just withdrawing from putting your energy into them.
Yeah.
So that your energy can be in relationship with them, with that balance, with that neutrality.
Yeah.
And in that space, I think about the experiment where they discovered the observer effect.
Mm-hmm.
And these quantum physicists in these laboratories were watching these molecules. And at some point, someone realized, oh my goodness, these tiny, tiny molecules are affected by us watching them.
Yeah.
We can't isolate the observer effect.
Yeah.
Because whenever we're watching something, it will create.
Yeah, that's a cool experiment. We should bring that in the next time and actually describe it, because it has to do with light passing through a field. Mm. And what's interesting is, you know, Neil deGrasse Tyson is a pretty avid atheist. But the Bhagavad Gita, which is clearly got a sense of a divine character in it, but it's the divine character as the observer energy, as the consciousness energy, which is given the name Krishna in the Gita. But one of the chapters is called The Knower and the Field. Mm-hmm. And in quantum physics, and I don't want to get too deep into this partly because I'm not a physicist and I might say it completely wrong, but everything exists in like a field of energy. Like, you know, space is like not space. It's a field. It's a thing. It's a medium, you know, and it curves and moves. And that's why light does what it does and how astronomers can figure out where places are, because they see this field warping and stuff. But in the Gita, Krishna, the teacher in this role, is saying, you will get it when you can understand the distinction between the knower and the field, where the field is the experiencing that we're doing, and the knower is the one who's having the enjoyment or the recognition of the experience. And so to me, that is just such a fascinating analogy, Right. And I'm sure Dr. Tyson would say, you know, you're totally wrong. I mean, he has lots of, I want to read more about some of his objections to those kinds of things. Because when we were back behind stage, he was arguing with someone about some of that kind of stuff.
Cool.
But to me, it matters and it doesn't matter, because we also are only living within our experience. So our ability to understand fields, we're either thinking about it, right? We can conceptualize it, or we can go to meditation and have a direct experience as much as we can. And some scientists, if they can't measure something, say, well, that's not, you know, we can't say, right? The smarter ones will say we can't say, the dumber ones will say that's not really there. So but as yogis, you know, we're working with what is our experience. We are using observation and personal experiencing and using discernment to try to figure out what's what.
I totally agree with you. I would just add in my experience that I think it is possible to experience other people's fields. It's just you can never experience it as they're experiencing it. Like in yoga teaching, we often do hands-on assists with people where we'll, like in down dog, we'll help to extend someone's spine. I think that in those experiences, it is possible to feel what the space around somebody is feeling, especially if you're sensitive, especially mm-hmm. if you're in that internal space where you're practicing samyama, where you've connected with the container, with that field of infinite intelligence, and your focus is not so overly stressed, right? Where you're working with drishti, and where mm-hmm. you can start to see things. You can start to see. It's not like the goal, but I think there is a way. But it comes from that simplicity again. You know, what do you think? What do you think of that?
Yeah, I mean, we're connected. We have a sense. Our senses, our five senses, tend toward seeing us as distinct, mm-hmm. right? It's part of the lila. Mm-hmm. But we are all literally the same stuff that emerged from the Big Bang. And we're just occupying a space-time continuum in which our experiencing is seeing us as different. Mm. I think in some other cultures, especially more primitive cultures where they haven't done that Cartesian split, you know, that they are more aware of that interconnectivity. So when we do it through some training in a yoga practice or in teaching, mm-hmm. what you were just describing, mm-hmm. yeah, you're feeling where you're connected, mm-hmm. how you're interconnected, mm-hmm. and people feel it in different ways, you know.
And it's interesting coming back to the cell phone thing, the cell phone on the couch, cell phone on the subway. What I think we're giving away when we do that is our capacity to feel in that way, because it becomes so focused in a mental eyes seeing, processing information way, yeah. that it trains us to be precise in that way, as opposed to feel, as opposed to be sentient. And
I think sometimes we're afraid, like we have these senses of, and it's scary. I mean, literally in the sutras, it's one of the obstructions to reaching this final states of meditation is we fear what we are going to experience, you know? So when you're with other people and you feel something from them, it can be disturbing, right? So you have to learn how to draw boundaries, how to balance yourself so that mm-hmm. you're not, you know, in any danger,
yeah.
right? That you're able to interact with them in a safe way. But that again is a part of practice.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting. I had this experience in class the other day with hands-on, because I'm very sensitive to receiving hands-on, and so often I'll tell people who are teachers in training, like, please don't touch me, because I get so distracted. Right. I get really pulled out of my practice when somebody comes and touches my hip and I'm like, oh, hi, I didn't see you coming. But it puts me in that very activated state. But I had this shift happen with somebody who I've pretty much been like, please don't touch me in class. It's not a personal thing between me and her as much as I need that for myself. I need that space. And something shifted for me. And I was like, you know, you can give me hands on. And it had a lot to do with me being in myself and feeling a type of, I don't want to say like command, but like a comfort in my own field.
Yeah.
Where I didn't feel like there's nothing that can come and harm me. Like I felt like I couldn't, like, it's so tricky to talk about these things because they're these subtle understandings within ourselves, but it felt that are then reflected into the world, into how people relate to us, I think. Talking about the field, this internal experience and how it reflects. But I had this like deep shift where I felt like I'm not threatened by this.
Right.
And that was a very little thing, but it was very big.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think we'll go through those kinds of adjustments.
Mm-hmm. You know? And there's nothing wrong with the other side. You know, like I think that there was nothing wrong with me not wanting the adjustments. And, you know, it's not like there's a problem that got fixed.
Right.
It was an evolution.
Yeah, and we just move through experience, and the more that we are practicing, and the better we're getting at navigating, and the more facility we have with being able to tap in for inspiration when we need it, then we just get different challenges as part of life, and the challenges don't feel so much like challenges. They're more just like interesting, like it's just things going on, you know? And so then we do that. That becomes like work, when you love your work. It's just what you're doing.
Right.
So you're going through and you're encountering something and it's just like, wow, you seem upset.
Yeah, there went a whale.
Yeah, so.
Yeah, we don't get pulled out of ourselves as much.
Yeah. So we're going to keep practicing. We're going to be in the field that we're in. And know the difference between the field and the observer. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh.
Well, thank you, Jenny.
You're welcome.
Always thank you. Lovely to talk with you.
You too.
Namaste.
Namaste.
In next week's episode, I'll be talking to Rachel Zinman, one of the trainers in my own teacher training, about what she's up to, which includes her new book, Yoga for Diabetes. She has a workshop on the topic at Ishta Yoga on November 2nd. I'm teaching a meditation training with Alan Finger and Sarah Finger in December and a 300-hour teacher training in January. I also teach regular asana and meditation classes there. See ishtayoga.com for details. I want to thank all of you who've already supported me at patreon.com. I couldn't do the show without you. And I ask everyone else who's enjoying this show to please let your friends know. Also, check me out on patreon.com, subscribe for any level you like, and know that you're helping this information get out to the world, including into your own two ears. Namaste.